We'll continue with our program, and now we move into the group of people Carlo was mentioning several times in his presentation, the future generation. We are moving into session number 3, contributions of the future generation to global food security. I want to thank briefly Professor Carolyn Beck in plant sciences and Professor Tim Jones in dietetics and human nutrition at McGill for chairing this session.
Thank you, Hugo. So I guess you figured out which of the co-chair is which in this. So I'm Tim Johns. So the I think the perspective one gets in looking being the co-chair of a session that's looking at contributions to the future generation to global food security is in large part to realize that although I feel I have a future, I also have a lot of past that I can reflect on at the same time. Not as much as Gene Doniffer by any means, but and certainly I think what I do realize is that things, although some things remain the same, food security certainly seemed as intractable as it did when I was a student. But if at the same time, when you think back and where we were, people would say, oh, things are changed by generations. And I guess maybe a generation has passed before I was, since I was in this situation. And indeed, things changed profoundly. And in ways that we probably couldn't anticipate it, but they do very much reflect the contributions of the new ideas that come into any particular field. And in this regard, certainly, I know that a generation from now that things will have changed profoundly, and it will be on the the ideas and the strong work of people that are represented by the three people that are on this panel today. The three panelists will have the usual amount of time, I guess, so roughly 10 minutes. And I'm the bad cop. Carolyn's the good cop in this regard. So I will be sitting up here timing people. The first speaker is Joanne Taylor. We have more McGill students on this program, and I think it's a real pleasure to have Joanne, who's a PhD student at the University of British Columbia Okanagan campus. She's in the, I understand, the interdisciplinary. What's the G stand for? The interdisciplinary studies, which is what I really want. I'm jealous. That's all I can say, because it's what I really wanted to study when I was a PhD student. So very much looking forward, Joanne, to your perspective. So welcome to the podium, wherever you are. There you are.
Thank you very much, Dr. Johns, and to the Indigenous peoples whose land we are gathered on. I'm extremely honored to have been included as a speaker for the McGill Global Food Conference. Thank you, Dr. Melgar Quinones. It is also a privilege to be here alongside my distinguished fellow panelists. Good afternoon, everyone. I'll be talking about food security, governance, and infrastructure in the Creston Valley of British Columbia along the Kootenai River, third largest tributary on the Columbia River. Although water for irrigation is currently plentiful in this area, the revitalization of Indigenous sturgeon upriver of the valley determines the current operation of the Kootenai River's Libby Dam. Together with unpredictable rain patterns due to extreme climate change, and as Dr. Madramutu alluded to in this morning's feature address, now creates a flooding hazard threatening crops grown in the valley. Due to the modern operating regime of Libby Dam, original diking infrastructures that protect the valley bottom are now degrading and are not up to provincial standards. Compounding this dilemma are administrative and regulatory agencies who are not taking responsibility for the repair and revitalization of the dikes, thus threatening food and agricultural security in the Creston Valley. Furthermore, small and medium farming communities in Canada are drastically decreasing, and Creston Valley is just one of those many. Canadian agricultural policy seems to be unable to tackle this issue, which has unpredictable consequences for food security locally, regionally, and nationally. I therefore argue that the upcoming renegotiation of a modernized transboundary Columbia River Treaty and management of the Libby Dam should include the restoration and protection of diking infrastructures that would create a much more food and agriculturally secure environment in the Creston Valley. Excuse me. The Columbia River is the, just want to make sure that I'm on the right slide here. Okay. The Columbia River is the largest North American river that empties into the Pacific Ocean and which spans both Canada and the U.S. Its headwaters lie in the Rocky Mountains, and 80% of its water drains into the Pacific Ocean at Astoria, Oregon State. The Kootenai River is one of the Columbia's uppermost major tributaries, also originating in the Canadian Rockies. It dips down into Montana, flows northwest into the Idaho Panhandle, re-entering Canada just south of Creston, BC, and joins the Columbia River at Castlegar. Libby Dam controls the Kootenai River flow. It is one of four Columbia River Treaty dams completed in 1973 and located in Libby, Montana. 25,000 acres of prime agricultural land rests between the Purcell and Selkirk mountain ranges, which are the source of plentiful rivers and creeks that drain into the Kootenai River floodplain, creating a beautifully protected and very fertile and unique ecosystem within the Columbia River Basin. In 1920, Creston Valley agriculture began to flourish, and by 1935, 165,000 bushels of wheat were cultivated. Today, the population of the fertile Creston Valley is approximately 7,000 people. It is a major exporter of alfalfa and timothy hay, a successful dairy industry, emerging niche markets such as canola, ostrich farms, hot pepper production, organic farms, and a small but growing wine industry. As Dr. McGurk talked about yesterday, there is an increasing diversity of agriculture that is demanded by urbanites nationally and internationally. This has contributed to an agricultural sector that has an estimated farm capital of $87.4 million and approximately $14 million in annual sales, providing economic stability, livelihoods, and security for farmers in this area for the past several decades. However, the financial security that farmers had once so easily attained is being threatened by further deterioration of aging diking infrastructures that the BC government will not take responsibility for repairing, despite enormous amounts of hydro dollars that are generated from the Columbia River each year. The first dikes were built in 1893 by English investors and miners in order to grow food in the valley bottom. By 1935, most of the valley bottom was dredged and about 8,000 acres were reclaimed at the south end of the valley. In 1997, pumps in various diking districts could not remove the floodwaters, and according to farmers, Creston lost 75% of its crops. Yet again in 2012, another high water event occurred when later than normal heavy spring runoff caused by higher than normal spring rainfall inundated Lake Koocanusa, Libby's reservoir, causing flooding along the Creston Valley floodplain and into the United States. Most farmers that I interviewed last spring in Creston do not have farm insurance, citing prohibitively high premiums. So crop losses were ultimately borne by the farmers themselves. The VARQ, or variable flow regime, was implemented by the U.S. Fisheries for the recruitment and revitalization of the Kootenai River white sturgeon. But it is inadvertently eroding the dikes caused by the fluctuations of water levels as repeated hydration and dehydration eventually breaks down the diking system. Sadly, the costs for repair are exorbitantly high for farming associations and diking districts to bear. Compounding this dilemma are impending climate change scenarios which alter seasonal rain patterns, thus affecting the possibility of increased flooding, which, without a safe diking system, threatens the future economic stability of agriculture in this area. The Columbia River Transboundary Treaty was implemented on September 16, 1964, 50 years ago, between Canada and the U.S. for a 60-year term. Currently, both the Canadian and the U.S. governments have been involved in studies and consultations that have determined that the treaty should be renewed. However, the governments will now address a much broader range of issues, such as continued regional population growth, severe long-term climate change by mid-century, and not to mention what Dr. Madramutu talked about this morning, decreasing financial capacity by governments to upgrade the diking infrastructures. Nowhere, however, in the many private consultations with constituents on the Canadian side of the Columbia Basin, has agriculture been specifically addressed. Nor has how a renewed treaty could potentially address food security for the farmers in the Creston Valley. More worrisome is the fact that the present Columbia River Treaty does not provide protection for farming communities in this region. I argue that the revitalization of deteriorating diking infrastructures in the Creston Valley should be included in the bilateral renegotiation talks of a renewed Columbia River Treaty. The Columbia River Treaty public consultation process was undertaken by BC Hydro and the Ministry of Energy, Mines and Natural Gas in 2010. In October of 2012, agriculturalists stated their concerns to the review team at an open house workshop about the eroding dikes along the Kootenai River. I was present at that consultation. When the issue of who should be responsible for the cost of upgrading and maintaining the dikes, the review team consulted an engineering firm to conduct an analysis on the integrity of the dikes. The engineering report, it was issued 1 month later, and in its conclusion, it stated that while considerable erosion did occur during the time previous to the adoption of the VARQ regime in 2002, and that localized erosion was continuing to occur and was threatening the stability of the dikes in several locations, erosion had decreased considerably, and therefore no further erosion should be taking place. Once again, farmers' concerns were ignored. Again, in March of 2013, Creston Valley farmers were told by the review team that they should attempt to create a water use plan, which would include the repair and maintenance of dikes, a cost that by some estimates would be in the millions of dollars to repair. The water use plan was developed by the province of BC and maintains that all provincially licensed reservoirs develop a water use plan. These plans define how dams are to be operated. The only problem is that Libby Dam is a U.S. structure, so it is impossible to implement a Canadian water use plan for an American structure. As Dr. McGuirk discussed yesterday, there must be coordination between farmers and policy, whether that is in Ethiopia or in the Creston Valley floodplains of BC. Indeed, the farmers must consolidate their efforts to bring about the transformative change that the province, and I would argue Canada, needs between small and medium-sized farming communities. Although my research site is already linked to the global economic food system, at the heart of this farming community are many other farmers who desperately depend on the safety and security of the floodplain, which in this case means holding back impending flood waters. As damming and diking infrastructures age, I believe it is the moral duty and social responsibility of the government to ensure the safety and security of these plains so that the farmers can continue to develop and maintain their economic livelihoods. The UNFAO states that we must promote sustainable land and water management and support local action for disaster risk reduction. This is the future of small family farming in Canada, and during this time, the diking dilemma could be included in the Columbia River Treaty negotiations. Just last week, my supervisor and I attended the 5th annual conference on the future of the Columbia River Basin in Spokane, Washington, where we raised the issue of agriculture in the Creston Valley, and the questions we presented engendered much needed discussion. The Minister of Energy and Environment spoke about the need for these issues to remain out of treaty negotiations, which brought forth catalytic discussions on developing policy within a potential Columbia River Commission, where issues such as underinvestment in diking structures could become policy. Policymakers must be made aware of the rural to urban food chains that are linked into global growth engines. It is therefore imperative that policymakers continue to support and facilitate agriculturalists in their efforts to both import and export their foods nationally and internationally in a safe and secure environment where impediments to water, land, and infrastructure must be addressed for the long-term success of this area and beyond. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joanne. We'll have the questions for the three speakers. Carolyn will chair that session at the end. The second speaker today, our first of our McGill students, is Hussein Mohammed, who's a doctoral student in human nutrition in the School of Dietetics and Human Nutrition. Hussein is first degrees from the University of Ghana, and where he also worked. He's not, as he'll tell you, his research now from the bio you see is actually not in Ghana, but in Ethiopia. So, Hussein, we look forward to hearing of you, more about your work.
Good afternoon. I would like to present the selected part of my research work in Ethiopia. I'll give you a little background, and then I'll go through most of the indicators that we went through in Ethiopia. Ethiopia is the second most populous sub-Saharan country. Most of its population are smallholder agriculture farmers, and they mostly produce for home consumption. They rely on traditional technologies, and Ethiopia has erratic rainfall, so they are prone to droughts. 40% of the population are undernourished, and the most vulnerable groups are pregnant women, infants, and young children. And this presentation will focus on these particular groups. Anemia prevalence in pregnant women is around 42%, and vitamin A deficiency is 38%. Children, anemia prevalence in children is 44%, and similar prevalence was also seen in stunting in the recent demographic and health survey. 70% of children reported fever 2 weeks before the survey, 17% reported acute respiratory tract infection, and there was a 13% prevalence of diarrhea. Ethiopia has achieved a lot with under 5 mortality. They've reduced it to around 67%. However, the rate, which is 68 per 1,000 live births, is still very high. This analysis intends to assess the association between food security and maternal vitamin A status, birth outcome, infant growth, and child mortality. The analysis is part of a broader studies that is a random clinical trial that is evaluating the effect of iodized salts consumption on child development in the Amhara region of Ethiopia. one village was selected per district, and a total of 44 districts were selected in five zones. And we have a little over 1,000 pregnant women were selected for this study. Selected women lived in the community for at least 1 year and intend to stay in the community for another 1 year. The women were followed up when their children were between 5 months and 13 months. Ethical approval was obtained from Ethiopian Public Health Institute and Ethiopian National Research Ethics Review Committee and then McGill University. Data were collected on household food security, social demographic characteristics, maternal obstetric history, past experience of under five mortality in households, maternal dietary diversity, infant morbidity, and infant anthropometry, among others. And this presentation will be based on these indicators. There are some other indicators that will not be shown here. The survey tool that we used to assess the food security was the Household Food Security Survey model. And this tool focuses on reported instances of uncertainty, insufficiency, and inadequacy of food. It also focuses on accessibility, availability, and utilization of food due to limited financial resources, and eventually compromised dietary pattern and food consumption. It has 18 items. The first 10 items assesses food security in adults. It asks questions an example of a question is a question that asks whether the household didn't get enough money to purchase enough food because they didn't have enough to purchase enough food because there was not enough money. And this was asked over the past 12 months. For a child, there are 8 items that assesses the child food insecurity. And similarly, they also ask whether one of the items asking if children did not eat enough because the household did not have enough money to purchase food. And together, we can assess the household food insecurity. In our results, most of the households had agricultural land, they rear livestock, but assets was low in our community among our subjects. Water and sanitation was poor. Most of the mothers didn't have formal education. They were farmers, and they had low dietary diversity score. A third of the women reported symptoms of night blindness when they were pregnant, and 2/3 of the women reported symptoms of anemia during pregnancy. Miscarriage prevalence was 13%, and stillbirths was 7%. We observed only 11% food insecurity, household food insecurity, and this was a lot lower than we expected. Previous survey in the same community 2 years ago reported over 40% food insecurity. But those households that were insecure, most of them were severely insecure. The same pattern was seen in child food insecurity. Prevalence of underweight was 20%. Wasting was 5% and stunting was 32%. 38% of the households have children who reported sick within 2 weeks of the survey, and 28% of the households have experienced under five mortality. Now, we compared the experience of various experiences with food insecurity and realized that there was high food insecurity in households that had low maternal education, low assets, low water and sanitation, and low maternal diversity. Dietary diversity. Also, there was high food insecurity in households that reported night blindness and stillbirth. And there was also high food insecurity in those that reported a child being sick and those that reported under five mortality. We did a logistic regression analysis to look at some of the other contributing factors, factors that were associated with some of our indicators. And we realized that decreased household food insecurity and increased maternal education and assets were associated with increased maternal dietary diversity score. And also increase in household food insecurity and underweight were associated with a child being sick. Increase in household food insecurity maternal age and number of children that the woman gave birth to were associated with increase in under 5 mortality. And interestingly, wasting was not associated with household food insecurity, but was associated with adult food insecurity. And maternal education was somewhat also associated with wasting. Increase in household food insecurity, maternal age, and decrease in water and sanitation was associated with increased stillbirth. An increase in household food insecurity and increase in number of births were associated with reported night blindness during pregnancy. In conclusion, food insecurity in our community was lower than we expected, and this may be because of the season. This survey was done during the bumper harvest. 2 years ago, the survey was taken during the lean season, so hence the difference between the two. And then, however, the food insecurity was associated with was an important risk factor in nutritional status of pregnant women, in adverse pregnancy outcome, poor child growth, and under 5 mortality. We need further studies is recommended in this area using different tools to assess food insecurity to realize the importance of food insecurity in these vulnerable groups. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Hussein. So the third of our speakers today, Rachel Krauss, take us to a different part of the world. So we have three different case studies here. From three different locations, and certainly on a variation of topics as well. Rachel is a doctoral candidate in Institute of Parasitology at McGill. Her work is in Panama, and obviously, if you don't associate parasites with food security, and hopefully you do, then she's going to tell us a lot more than what we should know.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we're going to talk about parasites, and within the context of a case study that we did in Panama. We were invited by the Panama Ministry of Health to evaluate a food security intervention that they had been carrying out. So when we arrived there and started our study in 2012, they'd already been working in these communities for about 5 years. But there was another group of communities that had started the program the year before. And as we began our data collection in February of that year, there was a third group that started the intervention. So it provided us with an interesting opportunity to look at how different lengths of exposure to this program were influencing household production and food security and also child health outcomes. So the intervention took place in 15 extremely poor rural communities. There were 238 families, 309 preschool children who participated in our study. These households were all extremely poor and also had inadequate access to clean drinking water and sanitation. And so not surprisingly, we found that about 50% of preschool children were stunted and intestinal parasites were endemic. These households all practice subsistence level agriculture. So they're doing slash and burn farming, growing mostly rice and maize, a few roots and tubers, some vegetables. Most households keep chickens, and some also kept pigs. And so it's within this context of extremely poor subsistence farming communities that the Verisan Food Insecurity Program of the Ministry of Health was begun. Their overall objective was to increase the agricultural production of households with the aim of improving household food security and child growth. They did this through agriculture training based in demonstration gardens, where people learn new vegetable cultivation techniques. They learned to make bokashi fertilizer, which is a fermented organic fertilizer. It comes from Japan, but it's become quite popular throughout Central America. Other soil conservation techniques. On top of that, Verisan staff also held nutrition and hygiene workshops in the communities. So this had been working quite well, but there was concern amongst families in the intervention and Verisan staff that there was an additional health problem that children were suffering from that wasn't being addressed by Verisyn, and this was intestinal parasites. So the two that we were most concerned with in this region are two nematodes, Ascaris lumbricoides and hookworm. They get into the environment with fecal material, which is why sanitation is such an issue. They develop best in warm, moist soils, and people become infected when they come into contact with these contaminated soils. And so it's easy to imagine how increased subsistence agriculture activities could lead people to be more in contact with soil and more at risk for picking up these parasites. And we're particularly concerned with regard to preschool children because we know that these parasites stunt their growth and their cognitive development. So we're trying to explore this, this whole system using an ecosystem approach to health framework. And I'm gonna actually break this down into a series of research questions that hopefully we'll answer by the end of this. So the first, we want to simply see whether Verisyn has improved agriculture in these communities. Then we'll see whether this has led to improved household food security, whether that's translated into better child diets. And then before we look at growth, we're going to swing down to the bottom of the framework and look at whether there are aspects of intensified household agriculture and exposure of children that have led to increased intestinal parasites. And then finally, we'll look at, on balance, what's happening with child growth. So our first question is whether Verisyn has improved agriculture. So when we asked households that were new to Verisyn what their barriers to growing enough food for their families were, one of them that they reported to us was that they didn't have enough knowledge about agriculture. So then we went and we asked everyone, what have you learned through Verisyn, and what are you using of these methods in your own home agriculture? And so you can see in this graph in the yellow bars, these are the households that are new to Verisyn, and they, and when we compare them with the households in the purple bars that have had the longest exposure to Verisyn, we see that these households have learned more types of methods, and they're also using them at home. Another barrier that new households reported to us was that they felt they didn't have enough land to grow the food that they needed. But when we then looked at the area that people were actually planting, there was no difference in how much they were planting. However, we found that they were growing more food. So here again in the yellow bars, households newer to the program grew fewer types of crops, fewer grains and starches, and also when we looked at the amount harvested of the primary staple crop, rice, we found that they were harvesting less than households in the purple bar that had been in the program for longer. And so what this tells us is that Verisyn has been successful in helping households to intensify their production through increasing knowledge. So now we want to see whether this has improved household food security. So we used an experience-based household food security questionnaire. This is from the same lineage as the other food security questionnaires we've looked at today, but it's being locally adapted in Panama. And so briefly, a score of 0 here is food secure households. So around 11% of households reported they were food secure. Majority of households were mildly food insecure. So they're reporting experiences like lacking money to purchase enough food. This questionnaire also has items around agriculture. So they reported that they had difficulty growing enough food because of inclement weather or because they lacked materials. And then an additional 16% of households were moderately or severely food insecure. So on top of these experiences, they also reported that they were decreasing the quantity or number of meals in their households, and also that they felt hungry. So we use a score to build multiple regression models. I'm not showing you all the model statistics here, just the p-values, and I wanted to demonstrate the relationship. So interestingly, these are subsistence households, but we found that recent income, so the per capita monthly income, as well as long-term household wealth, which we measured through an index based on purchased goods owned by the household, both of these were negatively correlated with food insecurity scores. So households with more short and long-term wealth had better food security. In addition to that, households that grew more rice also had better food security. So we've seen that Verisyn has improved agriculture, and this improved agriculture has led to better household food security. And then we wanted to see if this was actually translating into better child diets. So before we look at the models, I wanted to briefly describe the diets to you. So all children in this population are eating rice and maize, beans and lentils. And even in the group with the least diverse diets, these children, over 50% of them are eating some kind of animal source foods at least once a week. On top of this, children with the most diverse diets are also eating a greater variety of fruits and vegetables, particularly vitamin A-rich fruits and vegetables. So we developed a diet diversity score based on common methods in the literature to better conceptualize diet diversity, and then we used that score to build multiple regression models. There were three variables that emerged in our models, two that showed a positive relationship with diet diversity. So if households had received vegetables from the demonstration gardens that were part of the Verisign intervention, they had more diverse diets, as well children whose households grew more types of vegetables were also eating more types of foods. Conversely and interestingly, children of caregivers who spent more time working in the plot had poorer diets. And we're going to see this variable come up again. So there's something going on with caregivers being away from the home and perhaps unable to care for their children the way they would like to. So before we go on and look at what's happening with growth, we're going to look at intestinal infections and the relationship with agricultural practices and exposure. You'll remember there are two parasites that we're concerned with, and I've modeled them here separately because their transmission dynamics are slightly different. The first is Ascaris lamarckoides, which was found in 16% of the children at baseline. And there are a number of agriculture-related variables that emerged in our models. We found that the children of caregivers who spent more time working in the field, again, were at greater risk for infection. Also, if children accompanied their caregivers to the field, they were more likely to have higher infections. And families that had more intensive practices, here measured as the number of agricultural methods used by the household, those children also had higher infections. Similarly, hookworm infected 25% of the children at baseline. And again, if the caregiver spent more time working in the field and if the child went to the field with their caregiver, these children were likely to have higher infections. Number of methods used didn't emerge in the model, but we found that children of households that had larger agricultural plots actually were likely to have lower infections. So we've seen that agriculture can lead to better food security and to better child diets, but at the same time, there may be some aspects of agriculture in this context, at least, that are leading to greater risk of infections, which we know can have detrimental effects on child growth. So now we're going to look at what's actually happening with growth in this population. So here we're measuring growth as height for age Z-score. This is a standard WHO measure of growth stunting. And in this case, just briefly, a score of 0 would be considered normal height of a healthy child for their age group. And so we see in this population, using negative 2 standard deviations below 0 as our cutoff, 50% of children are stunted in their growth. From our multiple regression models, we found three variables emerge. There was one that increased growth in children, so households that had better food security, that had lower food insecurity scores, children in those households had higher height for age Z scores. But there were a couple of variables that diminished growth. So children who had hookworm infections that year had lower height for age Z scores, and children who visited the agriculture plot with their caregiver also had lower height for age Z scores. So there are aspects of agriculture and food security that can improve child growth, but at the same time, variables that are related to greater agriculture exposure and infection are having a negative effect on growth. So there are a number of conclusions and implications that we can draw from this study. First of all, we want to highlight the success that the Verisign program has had in increasing agricultural knowledge and production and also intensity of production in these communities. And this is really important because we saw in our analysis of food security that agricultural production plays a key role in households' food security. But we also saw in those analyses that short and long-term access to cash is also an important component of food security in this population, which creates a good opening for the introduction of more cash crops within this population. When I collected the data in 2012, about 10% of households told me that they had sold anything that they had grown. So there's lots of room for improvement there. There are also issues around caregivers work in agriculture. So we saw in the data just presented that caregivers who spent more time working in agriculture, their children tended to have lower diversity diets and also higher infections. So this speaks to gender inequalities within these communities, and the difficult position that women are in needing to be a part of the agricultural activities of their households and ensuring better food security, but also the needs of their children for them to have adequate time to care for them. We also found that children who were exposed to agriculture themselves had increased infections and decreased growth. And so the takeaway that I want you to go away from this talk with is that if we pay attention to child intestinal infections within these kinds of systems, we're likely to see an increased effectiveness of interventions in these populations. There have been a number of recent reviews of agricultural interventions that have brought up the concern that we've been doing these interventions for a long time, and we have a lot of studies on them now, and the evidence that they're leading to better child growth is rather disappointing. And they list a number of different reasons why this may be, and our study brings up an additional reason, which may be that within all of these systems, we need to also consider infection, not only nutrition, not only food intake, because infection is part of nutritional security. We visited Panama last summer, and we were able to meet with people who are staff of the Verisan program, and we found that within the team, there was good recognition of the importance of taking a multi-sector approach. So their teams are made up of agricultural specialists and nutritionists and educators and social workers, and together they're trying to address this very complex issue. But when we went on to meet with policy leaders, regional directors of health and agriculture and education, and we had the opportunity to meet with the Minister of Health, that gentleman on the right in the bottom photo, we found that policy making was still quite siloed. And so this is something we're hoping our study can open dialogue on. So just as I finish, I think my time is up, I wanted to acknowledge our many collaborators in Panama, particularly the staff of the Verisan program and families who had participated in the study, as well as our funding sources, NSERC and IDRC. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rachel, and thank you to the three speakers. Within the continuum of time, we've heard three stories from the present, but I think you agree with me that these are three students with very bright futures, and indeed the future is in very good hands. Thank you again. So Carolyn will share this session now. I think I can go sit down.
So I would invite the three speakers to come back up to the podium. So I just wanted to give just a really, really brief summary of what we heard, and what I think we can say today is that all of the systems here are very complex. We have to look at multi-stakeholders involved with these systems, and that there's surprises in these complex systems. One would always think that better agriculture meant better health, but not always, obviously. And that you have to take into account, when we looked at the Canadian sort of situation with agriculture, and when you have policies at very high levels play very important parts in how producers can continue to produce. In Ethiopia, a lot of issues there, and you can see how important women are to the agricultural production, and how many other factors start influencing these concerns about food security, and how seasons affect the type of data that you might be taking, whether it's what's happening there. And then if we look at Panama, as I mentioned, I always thought agriculture was very beneficial, but if you start looking at outside, the other things that influence it, the intestinal parasites, and also the concern that if you want to increase agricultural production and the caretaker has to leave to go to the plots, the impact that has on the children. So I think this sort of suggests the complexity of these systems, and single variables, single interpretations are difficult to make. So I'll open the floor to questions. I would ask maybe if people could be, you know, limit their comments and just give us a question, and maybe if you could address it either to the whole panel or to one of the people here. Okay. And if you could give your name first, then.
Okay, it's Gene Donifer, it's me again. A question for Hossein. It's in reference to your project in Ethiopia, but it's only indirectly related. As we know, Ethiopia has one of the poorest food security records in the world. What is the effect of the Saudi Arabian government's leasing about 1 million acres of land in Ethiopia for export of food to Saudi Arabia? What is the effect in the South Sudan of 250,000 acres being leased now for export of food? In other words, when we deal with food security, we're looking at the situation where food might be supplied internally, not where food is being exported at the same time. In the famines of 30 years ago, some of us remember that, in northern Ethiopia, there was much death in relation to the famine, and food was being exported from the south. Sugar cane, actually, sugar to the British market. It's geopolitics, and we may be nutritionists, and we may be something else, but it's pretty hard to avoid these other issues which come in and which affect very much the question of achieving food security.
Thank you very much. I think you made a very valid point. Whilst we try to address food security in various African countries, we must definitely consider the probability of, as we increase export, maybe we increase their income, etc. But we don't actually help with their food security situation, because now farmers, I'll give a typical example in Ghana, where a certain cash crop was introduced in a particular community. So farmers were producing food, now converted to cash crop production, and food production in that particular region dropped, and hence food security, of course. So sometimes we need to balance the two, even though policymakers would be more interested in how much, how to raise their GDP, we also have to worry about the population that we are dealing with. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll go over to the side now.
Hi, I'm Nadine Abet, and my question is for Hossein. You quickly mentioned that you were looking at the effects of iodized salt on child development. I was also wondering if you considered the effects of double fortified salt also. Seeing as you were funded by MI, I was just wondering if you looked at that as well.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we did not look at the effect of double fortified salt. We're just interested in the effect of just iodine in salt, because that is the commonest way of addressing iodine deficiency globally. But we don't have hard data to show exactly how much contribution is this iodized salt in terms of child development, mental development, physical development. So that is what this study intends to bring out, so that we can support policies on iodized salt fortification. In terms of the double fortified salt, when we look at our resource, we have seen that when we look at individuals who are severely anemic, that is iron deficient, severely iron deficient, you can see that the effect of iodized salt is a little bit lower, much, much lower compared to those who are less anemic. So you have a very valid point.
Hi, Felix Wangaya. A question for Joanne and Hossein, is it's pretty much the same kind of issue. Transboundary water agreements, because obviously the Columbia River, I would have thought going into the States, has to be a transboundary agreement. But also water is about one of the only things in Canada which actually comes under federal authority, albeit the reality is they seem to leave it to provincial sort of jurisdiction. So I'm just wondering, where does the stakeholder engagement kind of entitlement come in negotiating that transboundary agreement? And then for Hossein, you also have transboundary agreements with the Nile River Treaty. And I believe in Ethiopia you're damming it up quite a lot for power purposes and other purposes. So I was wondering if you could actually talk more about that as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Felix. That's a very good question. The Columbia River Treaty expires in 2024, and both sides have 10 years, starting from September 16th of this year, to either continue with the treaty as it exists now, to renegotiate a new treaty, or to cancel it. And both sides, Washington, D.C., and Ottawa, have decided that they would go ahead and renew the treaty. So they would add things to it that have not been included, had not been included in 1964. Indigenous concerns, climate change, population growth, fisheries, the ecosystem, the environment are all on the table now. So about 5 years ago, the Canadian government, more specifically the provincial government, started a consultation process that goes around within the Columbia River Basin in British Columbia and speaks to people who are potentially stakeholders. So that would include First Nations, Indigenous people, tribes in the U.S., transportation, irrigation, but unfortunately farmers, who are not the most vocal group, probably because they're working so much out in the field, are never really included in those talks. Now, the most vocal participants that have been there are the fisheries people. And fisheries and the revitalization of fisheries, both across the border and in Canada, have been very vocal, and they are actually being included in the new renegotiation of the new treaty. Agriculture, First Nations issues are being excluded from the treaty, so we heard last week. And they will be negotiating for their rights, potentially through a commission that we had discussed. So through that type of participation, we are hoping to see more inclusion of farming communities.
On Ethiopia, I can't give you a lot of information, but what I can tell you is that the new government of Ethiopia, I mean the previous government was less active, but the new government has centered most of Ethiopian policy around agriculture and around food production. And this has actually been disseminated down to the village level.
Mary?
Hi.
My name is Kisa Givink. I'm a student at McGill. And my question is for Rachel. Parasites are usually kind of associated with sanitization practices, I guess. And I was wondering if you guys took that into consideration when you were like collecting your figures for, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, and is this on? Yeah?
Is it? Yeah, I think it is.
Can you hear me? Okay. And certainly, whenever we're collecting data on this kind of infection that's very related to sanitation, that's something that we control for. In this population, we found that, something like a third of mothers said that their children were freely defecating around their yards. And that kind of contamination doesn't stay in one place, right? It gets moved around by animals or rainwater or
people.
Yeah, exactly. These parascites, especially Ascaris, they can stay in the environment and be infected for years and years. So that's one of the reasons why multi-pronged approaches to dealing with these kinds of infections are being used. That it's not just about putting toilets in, which is important, but also surprisingly difficult to do, but it's also about hygiene and treatment and nutrition.
Hugo Melgar Quiñones, I want to thank you, three of you, for your great presentations. The context you presented to each of your studies is very, very helpful for understanding the specific questions of your research. And I don't want to remove us from that and those environmental factors and different challenges. And my biomedical background is still a bias nowadays. And my question is actually for Rachel. If you could expand just a tiny bit on what the mechanisms are that link parasitic infection with stunting. And just briefly to mention also that there is very strong evidence coming from the Delhi School of Economics relating open-air defecation with stunting as well.
Yeah, so there are a number of, that's a good question. There are a number of mechanisms that drive the relationship between infection and stunting, especially in young children. So there's simply the fact that children who are infected are uncomfortable. They maybe don't want to eat, so you see anorexia with them. They can also cause diarrhea, which is loss of nutrients. Parasites themselves are competing with the host for nutrients. Some of these, so Ascaris, the females are about this big. And if we're talking about two-year-olds, it's not hard to imagine how a few of those worms in a kid can lead to a lot of interference with their growth. And in some of these children, my supervisor, Dr. Scott, can tell you a story about one of her students collecting worms from small children, and they were astounded by the numbers of worms coming out of these kids. So the problem with these parasites aren't that they cause mortality. Occasionally they do, but not very often. The problem is that they cause morbidity and stunted growth. And there's really interesting data on countrywide economic losses due to morbidity losses in economic activity.
Okay, so we have time for a couple more. Well, you still have to use the microphone. I'm sorry. And you have to say your name.
I do. I've forgotten my name. I'm getting too old to remember my name. I've been trying to convince you of that anyway. What I was thinking about the three of you together, and I know, Rachel, your work in your bio, it has policy implications. You've been involved in some discussions at that level. Joanne, your work goes beyond policy. You're already engaged in politics. And I certainly know when I was a graduate student, and we look at the way we train graduate students to sort of often to have a very narrow focus to think about, you know, just doing the work that needs to be done, collecting the data. And ask the three of you, sort of, where do you see that at somebody at your stage? How have you, and do you think it's you're successful, can be successful in balancing the need to do your thesis in the most rigorous way and getting engaged in levels that are beyond the science or beyond the academic side of things?
Who would like to take it first?
Joanne, I think you should go first.
Thank you, Dr. Johns. Yes, well, I look at food security in the Creston Valley, and I look at more specifically the processes that are challenging food security in that region. And we're looking at five specific processes. One is what I presented on today, which is the Columbia River Treaty and how it serves to exclude rather than include agriculturalists. I also look at how small farming communities are continuing to lose their farming families. Young people just don't want to get into farming anymore. Our particular government in British Columbia has an agricultural land reserve that has all but taken all of the agricultural land out of the reserve now for development, mostly extractive resource development, which is your gas mostly now, and dam building. So that is not serving the farmers very well. There are just two regions left in British Columbia now, the Okanagan and the Fraser Valley for agriculture. Other processes that I look at as an environmental anthropologist is environmental climate change, what is happening to our water supply in that area. Although we're quite close to the Rocky Mountains and water currently is plentiful, so we have flooding issues. Within 50 years, we will definitely have a decrease in water supply for those areas. So population growth, so farmers are leaving that area, but the very wealthy people from Alberta are coming into these areas who want to have that, ideal settler society life. very reminiscent of the turn of the century. So while all of these factors are contributing to, you know, development, it's not contributing to what I would argue food security. So food is not necessarily being grown in the valley. They are cash crops. They're mostly for export to Asian countries, which is very good for the farmers who are farming the canola and the very expensive Timothy hay to racehorses in Asian countries. So more specifically, I think my dissertation will include probably chapters on all those five processes right now. And then when I delve more into that research, I will become more specific in each area.
But you're personally engaged in some of those issues. Those are very emotional issues in many ways. How do you balance your own engagement versus the academic and the thesis?
Well, I use a methodology that is a social science methodology. I try to balance qualitative and quantitative research, and my research design will include those two components. But as a social scientist and an anthropologist, I do rely on an ethnographic methodology, which is the interview. So I will go out and interview. I've already interviewed a few, but I will go out and interview several hundreds of farmers and see how they feel and look for emerging trends and see if that correlates with my own hypothesis.
Rachel, do you want to say next?
Sure, yeah. So we're talking about balancing research and getting involved, and I think precursor to that is actually learning how to engage with policy, how to understand policy. And one of the ways that I've done that and that McGill is really good in is getting involved in multidisciplinary conversations. So the School of Environment, the Food Security Institute at campus. Learning to talk cross-discipline has been a good primer in learning to talk to non-scientists, non-parasitologists. And I think the other piece is that sometimes it takes a little bit of time, but those of us who work in field settings, I think I can probably speak for most of us that we do feel a responsibility to the communities that we engage in. And granting agencies, especially IDRC, now requests that you outline in your proposal how you're going to use the knowledge that you gain through your work. And further, I think that there's actually just from personal experience recently in Panama, there are really interesting feedbacks that happen when you start engaging with policymakers and knowledge end users that actually can inform your analysis and future design of questions. So it's not entirely selfless. There's good information and good analysis that comes out of these conversations.
Okay. For me, in Ethiopia, the policy on iodized salt, universal salt iodization, was introduced much later. This particular research that we did started in 2011 and ended around 2013. They are still doing some analysis over there, and we were influential in helping them see how important iodized salt has become in addressing malnutrition, addressing certain aspects of nutrition. Example, when you look at the cognitive development of children, if you look at the baseline, you can see that the cognitive development of children typically in the mountainous part of Ethiopia was really bad. But after that policy, you can see that there was a massive improvement in that. And that in itself has encouraged the policymakers in Ethiopia to step up efforts to control and to enforce this particular law. And then we worked with so many government agencies, and the Health Bureau, and even the Vice President has been very much personally interested in our project, because they are interested in the findings of this project as a tool to use for their policies, and also to gain funding for some of these projects that they are doing to address malnutrition in this area.
Okay, thank you. Professor Raglan?
Thank you. Rachel, you had fantastic data about showing the advantages of what's going on, but then there was a negative attributes with respect to the parasites. In North America, we are looking at what should be my water quality to prevent. It's all related to food safety. So therefore, these kind of projects, should we be, in addition to the food security, should we be integrating with food safety, which in your particular case, perhaps the educational aspect associated with it. Should that be the part and parcel of the package?
Yeah, I think certainly. Food security or food safety, though, implies standards, and it implies some kind of policing of those standards. And when we're talking about self-grown food, subsistence livelihoods, that becomes much more complicated. So it's not simply that producers need to be following certain procedures, but that if you're growing vegetables at your home, you need to be certain that they're not contaminated. So I'm not sure what that would look like in that kind of subsistence context.
Perhaps the, yeah. Traditionally that's how it has been done, but in future considerations, probably we need to look at that aspect of it as well so that we can have a positive impact.
Yeah, and a question that remains in our work is, what is going on in the fields that children are picking up infections out in the field? This isn't like in many parts of South Asia or other regions of the world where human feces are recycled as manure. That doesn't really happen here, so it's not that obvious answer. I'm gonna go back in January and actually go back to the communities and report on that data that we found and have some conversations with women there to see what they think is going on and how they think they can mitigate the risks for infection to their children, what kind of supports they need from the Ministry of Health to do that.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. We could have one more question if anybody has one. No? Okay, I would like to take this minute to thank all three members of the panel, Rachel, Joanne, and Hussein. Excellent talks, really informative, and this is looking forward to the future of what's going to be happening out there. And I'd like everybody to give a big round of applause.
Thank you very much again to the three speakers. And I want to use this opportunity also to express my deep gratitude to Professor Caroline Beck and Professor Tim Jones. The first time I participated in this conference about 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to co-chair a session with Tim. And at that conference, I learned about the contribution of Caroline to the student sessions year by year. I know that the two of you have been extremely supportive of this conference and specifically to the contribution of our graduate students. There are a number of posters that show also the work of several of our students in different countries, China, Ecuador, Haiti, Guatemala, etc. And that is also a contribution from professors like Karen Beck and Tim Jones. Thank you so much for that. Before we embark in the last session, we do have 10 to 15 minutes for a health break. I know that there are some yoga trainers.